This presentation has been prepared by Cyforth Shaw, LLP, for informational purposes only and is not legal advice. This information is not intended to create, and receipt of it does not constitute an attorney-client relationship. Participants should not act upon this information without seeking professional counsel. The material discussed during the webinar should not be construed as legal advice or legal opinion on any specific facts or circumstances. The content is intended for general information purposes only, and you are urged to consult a lawyer concerning your own situation and any specific legal questions you may have. Any tax information or written tax advice contained herein, including any attachments, is not intended to be and cannot be used by any taxpayer for the purposes of avoiding tax penalties that may be imposed on the taxpayer. At this time, I would like to turn today's call over to Dan Lasalotto. You may begin.
Thank you. I want to thank everyone and say good afternoon. Thank you for attending this presentation on protecting confidential information and client relationships in the financial services industry. My name is Dan Lasalotto, and I'm a partner in the Chicago office. I'm here with my partners, Jason Steele and Scott Humphrey. Together, we are all in the trade secrets practice group here at Cyforth, and the majority of what we do in our practice deals with trade secrets, litigation, counseling, also non-compete counseling and litigation. So with that, we'll begin. What we'll cover today during our presentation, the first question we're going to cover are, what are trade secrets? I'll be discussing that. Jason will discuss what practical steps that financial services can implement to protect trade secrets and client relationships. Scott Humphrey will discuss what you should do if a FINRA member takes your trade secrets or violates his or her agreements. And also, he will discuss the FINRA rules and the protocol for broker recruiting, what you need to know. So the first question is, what is a trade secret? Well, probably the most famous trade secret is the recipe for Coca-Cola, but other famous trade secrets include the formula for WD-40 and even the Colonel's secret recipe. But exactly what a trade secret is, as one court had said, it's one of the most elusive and difficult concepts in the law to define. There's something called the Uniform Trade Secrets Act that was published back in 1979 and amended in 1985. And what it does is it provides a uniform definition of a trade secret and the criteria for achieving trade secret status. It also defines what misappropriation means, and it defines who the persons or entities are that can be liable for trade secret misappropriation. It also provides for remedies for misappropriation, which can include injunctive relief, damages, and even in some cases, attorney's fees. The Uniform Trade Secrets Act has been adopted by most states. As of 2012, there were 47 states that had adopted some form of the Trade Secrets Act. Actually, in 2013, in the beginning of May, Texas enacted the Trade Secret Act, bringing the number of states who have some form of the act to 48. The only two states as of today that do not follow the trade, do not have any form of the Trade Secret Act, are Massachusetts and New York. And in fact, earlier this year in January, Massachusetts lawmakers submitted a proposed legislation to adopt a form of the Uniform Trade Secrets Act. And it's expected that that will pass into law before the end of the year. So that would leave New York, who would follow just common law on the on trade secret issues. The common law, however, is similar to the Uniform Trade Secrets Act, and in fact, the act was developed using concepts and law that had developed over the years in the common law. So the formal definition for a trade secret under the Uniform Trade Secret Act is, you can see on the screen there, information including a formula, pattern, compilation, program, device, method, technique, or process that, one, derives independent economic value, actual or potential, from not being generally known, two, and not being readily ascertainable by proper means by other persons who can obtain economic value from its disclosure or use, and two is the subject of efforts that are reasonable under the circumstances to maintain its secrecy. So in simpler terms, what that means is a trade secret is something that, one, it has to be a secret, meaning it's not generally known in the industry, and it gives the owner of that trade secret a competitive advantage over others in the industry. Two, it cannot be reverse engineered by a competitor except with significant investment of time, effort, and expense. So in addition to being a secret, it also has to be kept a secret or maintained a secret. What the owner has to do is take affirmative measures to safeguard the secrets in a manner that's reasonable under the circumstances. And Jason will discuss in more detail the types of things that can be done and that are considered reasonable under the circumstances to maintain confidential information as a trade secret. So in the financial services industries, the types of materials that can, if they're protected properly, be considered and be found to be a trade secret include internal customer or supplier lists, things like high trading or high net worth clients and their order histories, institutional fund clients, pension fund clients and their portfolio allocations, angel / venture capital investors and their propensities. Also, internal modeling documents such as cash flow forecast models, options, future pricing models, underwriting models, and analytics compilations and modeling can be trade secret. Finally, another category is internal opportunities and trends information such as SWOT analyses or future private equity targets or information about emerging markets. If that is properly maintained as a secret, can constitute a trade secret. Things, however, that are generally not found to be trade secret would include information that is publicly available, what they call scratched surface type information, things that you can find in publications such as the Wall Street Journal, Dun & Bradstreet Company abstracts, information that you can find on blogs, message boards, or other publicly available forums. Also, off-the-shelf software programs are generally not considered to be trade secret. That would include things like unimproved credit risk or insurance risk programs that are purchased off the shelf. Also, Excel spreadsheets that are populated with simple formulas or information, that type of information is generally not treated by courts to be trade secret. So now we're going to be turning to the practical steps, and I'll turn it over to Jason.
Thanks, Dan. Again, my name is Jason Steele. I'm a partner as well in the Trade Secret Practice Group. We'll start off with a little cartoon here, and I'm sure most of you have been sitting on a plane next to somebody who's probably less than careful with their documents and work products. So here it is, the guy sitting next to him saying, looking over his shoulder, "You spelled confidential wrong." Part of our job when we first come as litigators is trying to assess how well the company has done in protecting what they consider to be their trade secrets. And as we'll talk throughout this part of the presentation, it really requires two things. And the first is the most important and often the one that's forgotten, which is understanding what, in fact, are your trade secrets. And then second, obviously, is then figuring out how to protect them. As the latter part, a company must make sure that they do not let their trade secrets out by any means. And these cases are examples of basically the minute that a trade secret walks out the door, becomes publicly known, it loses its status as a trade secret. So obviously, therefore, it's axiomatic that without secrecy, no trade secret can exist. Obviously, it doesn't require Herculean efforts to protect your secrets, but as Dan mentioned, it's got to be reasonable under the circumstances. Obviously, that will then depend upon what kind of company you have and how valuable or what markets you're using your trade secrets in. So, for example, in the financial services industry, certain customer lists, as Scott will talk about, may on their face themselves not be trade secrets, but the underlying data that supports those customer lists, their history, their purchasing, their trades, their transactions, those things may in fact be trade secrets. And so you need to put into place things that protect those trade secrets. Then if a trade secret does get out by some method, you need to figure out how quickly and be prepared to quickly address the loss of that trade secret and to get it back in and to minimize the damage. So we have several things we suggest to our clients, and obviously we can go through these with in more detail offline, but from a high level, we start with agreements with employees, and obviously it's the first kind of wall we'd suggest you put up. We first talk about proprietary information or non-disclosure, return of material agreements. Typically all of that is included, as well as an invention assignment agreement. We typically recommend including all of that into one contract that basically identifies from a high level the types of information you expect your employees to be dealing with on a day-to-day basis, and then putting together some enforceable boundaries for how and when that information can be used. The second recommendation we make, and it's also a critical one, is to have in place employee handbooks and policies. And while some states do not recognize those as contracts, you'd be surprised at how many that do, and at least in the trade secret context, find them to be binding obligations on employees. So it's critical that, one, you have the handbooks and policies in place that govern the use of your confidential trade secret information, but in addition, that those policies and handbooks marry up to whatever restrictions you put on your employees through their contracts. The third thing is, and this is one that's often forgotten, just because in the fast pace of business, it just gets overlooked. But a lot of times you're sharing information with vendors and clients on a day-to-day basis, and you're not considering what happens if your client possesses that information or your vendor has that information, and later down the line become a vendor for a competitor. It's important that if you really believe that you're handing off information that's sensitive to your company, that you ensure that your vendors and clients also have a confidentiality and or non-disclosure obligation. Likewise, in due diligence situations, it's critical that if you're getting into a situation where you'd be sharing that kind of information in any form, whether it's on cloud or in person, that there's obligations put on both sides to ensure that the information is maintained confidential. Also, when I talk about a cloud or even your internal facilities, you've got to put password protection. I mean, that's pretty much the first thing a court looks at in litigation to ensure that you're protecting your information is, do you password protect your information or encrypt your information? Second is need to know. Try to institute levels of distribution. If it's the keys to the kingdom, it's probably best not to have your low-level salesperson have access to that either through an online website or through passing it out through a PowerPoint presentation. Lock and key, not all courts require it, but it's always the best practice that your most sensitive things should be literally maintained if it's physically in a cabinet in a locked room with limited access and ideally a way to trace the persons who come in and out of access, and that's true obviously online as well. Notices. I will tell you right now, I'm litigating a case for a client that we got through a trial, and the last question the judge asked was, I don't see a confidentiality marking on these documents. I understand they're used only internally, but what is it that makes this, the employee know that they can't distribute it? And obviously we go back to the handbooks and the policies, but it's an easy step to take is to take your documents and put a stamp on them, put confidential, put it for internal use only, and make that almost a default for anything you're using when it's an internal document. And I'll have Scott will talk later about the protocol for broker recruiting and how it affects these types of efforts. I mentioned putting trade secrets into what we call cloud, which is kind of a fancy word for the internet, but basically an off-site host of your information. It becomes dicier, and there's a lot of case law that's developing in this area about what extra efforts need to be maintained when you're basically putting your information into someone else's hands. The vendor contracts obviously become critical, and you lose some of your negotiating rights, obviously, when you're contracting with a Facebook or a LinkedIn or a Oracle who's hosting information. But it's critical you understand what your obligations are. There are a lot of provisions that if you look in the fine print with a lot of those companies that say, you put your IP on our website and we can share it. So make sure you understand what your contracts say. Also know that when you're putting it in the cloud, you're going to be more susceptible to attacks. And obviously, if you're not comfortable knowing the security levels that are in place, get to know your vendor security levels. As I mentioned before, data ownership, there may be policies and provisions in the contracts which may, to your surprise, show that it's not you that owns the information you've somehow hosted on a website. So be sure you understand what that is. continuity of access to data, make sure that there's some sort of survival provision that you're going to know what happens if you decide to switch providers, or if there's some contract dispute with your provider that somehow they don't lay claim to your information just because you failed to make a payment, or you breached a contract, or decided to move away later. And finally, the jurisdiction and e-discovery, obviously, just like in any contract situation, knowing where the case is going to be brought and what steps you need to take to preserve that information is critical, and we would suggest you get in touch with an e-discovery lawyer to ensure, before you make the decision to host things in the cloud, what steps you can do to protect that. Just for fun, what we've been talking about here is the types of trade secrets. Traditionally, the way these things go out the door were binders, briefcases, and boxes as the employee leaves in the dark of night. That's not the way these things leave anymore. And if you go what we call new school, it leaves on Blackberries, it leaves on iPhones, it leaves on thumb drives, it leaves on disks. And the capability of a company to know where that information has gone, and even in forensic review later, becomes incredibly difficult because basically most companies just don't put tracking mechanisms to know when information is leaving. I don't mean to sound Orwellian, but you may consider, if you do believe you've got sensitive price lists, customer lists, whatever it may be, to put some sort of way to track USB use, because I will tell you, 9 out of 10 cases that we litigate, that's the way the information is walking out the door. Real quickly, I'm not going to cover too much on this slide, but I do want to tell you that when we're talking about putting things on a cloud, I mentioned earlier knowing what your trade secrets are. The second bullet point on here, trade secret audit, I can't stress this enough. It's a minimal effort by your company to have someone come in and look through and interview a few people and find out exactly what it is the company believes to be the most important things, whether it's, again, the customer list, pricing information, databases, whatever it may be, and let someone advise you what you can do to make sure that that information is protected as well as possible. Let me talk about employee social media policies. That's becoming, again, a kind of a increasing area where we're litigating, is that the policies that in place between an employee and an employer regarding what they can and can't post on, for example, their LinkedIn or Facebook, make sure you put something in place, and we've got obviously suggestions that we can make offline if you'd like, that restricts what an employee can do and, frankly, who owns the information once it's put out onto those websites. So now we've talked about how you protect your information when it's day-to-day business. The question is then, if we have an employee who's departing, what do we do? The first thing that is absolutely necessary is an exit interview. And I know, again, from experience that a lot of times it's rushed or the person leaves and you don't know they're leaving. Make it part of your process. An exit interview gives you several things. It gives you time. It also gives you a face-to-face meeting with a departing employee, and we have found that more likely than not, an employee has a hard time lying face-to-face about where they're going and what they're doing. Ideally, what you do in conjunction with an exit interview is you'd have an actual document of a questionnaire that says, hey, where are you going? You understand you've got obligations, et cetera, but at least an exit interview. Make sure that when you know they're leaving, that you have all passwords and all access put on hold, deleted, removed, so that guy walks out the door and gets on his iPhone and accesses your server and he starts taking documents. You want to make that shut off immediately. That's true for key card access as well, the traditional keys and key cards. Make sure that you've asked the employee to return all documents, all manuals, all internal materials. Make sure you have someone literally walk the employee out. Obviously that becomes a sensitive issue depending on the friendliness of the departure, but even a friendly one doesn't have to be, hands behind the back, walk out the door and embarrass them, but at least have someone kind of overseeing where the guy's going and what he's doing when he's leaving, because, again, it doesn't take much to put a USB thumb drive into your pocket. And then also know prior to the employee, before you hire them, make sure you know where they've been and what they've done prior to coming into your company. Now the employee's left, what do you do? First thing, look at your internal information. Go through your documents. See if you make sure you've got everything that you think that employee had. And if you don't, figure out what they were looking at and what might be missing. Two, interview people that are close to the employee and figure out what he was working on, what kind of clients he was servicing, and what kind of documents he may have been relying upon during that process, so you know what you should be looking for to make sure it's all there. Get in touch with your clients. I can't emphasize this one enough either. If you've got a concern that one of your employees is going to start reaching out to your clients, be the first one to do it. It doesn't have to be in the context of your departing employee, but just, hey, how are things going, making sure you're happy, et cetera, et cetera. Also understand what your company property is and make sure it's all there. External information transfer forms. Obviously, in the financial services, when a customer leaves, you may start getting requests that information transfer from the former company to the new company. If that happens in bulk, that should be a sign to you that there's a problem and that person's probably not using his memory to rely upon his customers to get new customers. Tombstones and brochures, see what the guy's sending out via email or publication regarding his new positions and where he's going. If you have concerns, or frankly, if you have the capability, if you don't have concerns, do a quick forensic review. It doesn't have to be high level, but search emails for certain high level words that you may have concerns about, for example, the new employer's name, or have a guy go through and check out kind of the last activities on that computer. And again, reach out to your client and understand what they've been doing and what they're expecting from you. Lastly, I want to talk about what your legal options are. Hopefully none of you ever have to worry about that, but the first thing is know what kind of what rights you have under your agreements and be prepared to enforce them if necessary. Understand what statutory rights you may have. Here we mentioned the UTSA that Dan talked about. CFAA is the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. That's a huge area of litigation lately. Some jurisdictions have been very broad about enforcing against departing employees. Some have been very narrow. The Espionage Act is a federal act that you may have criminal responsibility. Some of you may have been familiar with some of the cases going on with the China and the Motorola case. I think that was brought under the Espionage Act. Injunctions. You can get temporary restraining orders, which is you go into court immediately to stop the transfer or removal of your information. Scott will talk some more about how that interplays with the FINRA and the broker protocol obligations. Interlocutory injunction and a permanent injunction basically are mechanisms that you can use to restrain and prevent immediate departure of your information or ongoing in the permanent sense. Money damages, you should have drafted in your contract that even if you're going to have money damages, you can still get an injunction, but some of the options you may have is lost profits, salary and benefits if it's a breach of fiduciary duty, damage to your goodwill, which is typically what we look at in trade secret departures, diminished value of the trade secret, and then reasonable royalties. If you can put a dollar amount on what basically if two parties coming together would have negotiated for the information that's been removed, that's what's called a reasonable royalty under the Trade Secret Act. And finally, as Dan mentioned, some of the statutory provisions do provide for attorney's fees, typically if it's willful or malicious. Some and also will allow for punitive damages depending on the circumstances. And now I'll turn it over to Scott Humphrey. Oh, I'm sorry. Before I do, the moment you've all been waiting for. If you would like to receive CLE credit for this webinar, you need to write down this following code, which will be your CLE attendance affirmation code to put on your form, which you'll be emailed at the end of this week. The code is SS0267. Again, due to the length of the webinar, this is the only time we will give the verification code. Thank you.
Thank you, Jason. So what about FINRA, the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, which, as we all know, is the private independent regulatory agency for all securities firms? Well, FINRA has developed basically its own rules when it comes to broker-to-broker disputes or registered businesses-to-registered businesses disputes. And what we mean by that is, whereas if this was just what we would call the average run-of-the-mill trade secret or non-compete case, you would simply go into court and you would go to the judge and you'd ask the judge to enjoin these people from leaving or from soliciting clients of yours, enjoin these people from using your trade secrets when they leave and things like that. Well, what FINRA does and what in particular Rule 13804 does is it basically takes the power of the court and makes that power within FINRA after the temporary restraining order stage. And what I mean by that is if you are going to file a non-compete confidentiality injunction type case against former brokers who have left and gone to a competitor, you can go ahead and you can file that in the courts, but you must also at the same time be filing that action with FINRA. And then what happens under Rule 13804 is you can go into court and seek that temporary restraining order, that type of preliminary injunctive relief. But once you obtain it, you automatically have to go to FINRA, and FINRA will convene a panel within 15 days of the temporary restraining order, and the FINRA panel will decide whether or not it's going to allow that TRO to stand, whether or not they're going to order that the TRO be dissolved or if they are going to modify that TRO in some shape, way, or form. And then the parties are required to go back to the court and advise the court of the FINRA panel's decision, and the court then takes, if it has to, additional action to modify, dissolve, or allow to stand that temporary restraining order while the parties then move through towards FINRA. So you will only get a limited window of time to be in front of a court, and it's really just that TRO time. After that, FINRA takes over, and FINRA will govern your dispute from start to finish. What FINRA also does, and this impacts not only litigation, but also perhaps some of your employment agreements, is two rules, 11870 and 2140, specifically state that you cannot prevent account transfers. And 2140 even goes so far as to say that includes asking a court for injunctive relief, preliminary or otherwise. And what that means is if a customer wants to leave you to go with that broker, if you have an agreement that prohibits that type of smooth transfer, FINRA says that's not enforceable. What it also says, and what 2140 specifically says, is if you're going in to seek a restriction that would prevent that customer from leaving you and going with the customer, that's also going to be difficult under FINRA. So non-competes, in the strictest sense, and when I talk about non-competes, obviously, you know, we use that term somewhat generically. They can be non-compete, non-solicit, non-hire. FINRA rules don't prevent non-solicit or non-hires from being unenforceable. They will follow them. But when you get into a non-compete setting, you have to be very careful, and you have to be careful with how you word both your complaint as well as the injunctive relief that you are seeking, because a smart attorney on the other side will use Rule 2140 and then Rule 11870 to say, listen, this order is going to somehow prevent the smooth transition of customers. That can't be allowed under FINRA. So now you're in FINRA. Well, what does that mean? Well, the easiest way to compare it is court formal. You have rules of civil procedure, you have local district court rules, and then you have the judge's own standing order. So they'll set up the parameters of what you can and cannot do, and usually everybody understands what that is. FINRA is very much informal. There's a lot less rules. There's also a lot less discovery, whereas in court, you can send out interrogatories, document requests, depositions. FINRA pretty much only allows you document requests. They do allow you to take a deposition in, quote, extraordinary circumstances, but that extraordinary circumstance pretty much means somebody isn't going to be available to testify at the arbitration hearing, and therefore you're taking their deposition not as a fact-finding situation that you would in a typical deposition, but basically to preserve testimony that you can then read to the arbitration panel, or if you're going to videotape the deposition, allow the arbitration panel to review at the actual hearing. You also in court can go from TRO, preliminary injunction, to permanent injunctive relief, but that's not the case in FINRA. FINRA, they'll look at the temporary restraining order after 15 days, and then that's pretty much it. You're pretty much then limited to monetary damages. Rules of evidence, yeah, you better follow them in court, but FINRA, they don't even know what they are. And so what that does is, whereas in court, you know, at trial, you have, you know, set guidelines, set boundaries, everybody sort of knows the rules. FINRA arbitrations without the rules of evidence, along with the make of the panel, which may, if you're lucky, include one lawyer, but for the most part are going to be non-lawyers, industry representatives, it can turn into the wild, wild west where anything goes, where somebody might have heard the word hearsay, but they don't know what it means. So anything you want in at the arbitration hearing is likely coming in. And that also leads to arbitrator justice, where panels sometimes focus more on what's the right thing to do as opposed to what does the contract say and should I apply it, which is obviously what you have when a judge is deciding on injunctive relief or when a jury is deciding a case based upon jury instructions. So those are things to be cognizant of when you file your case in court and then it gets moved into the FINRA world. So then to add a little bit more to the story is this protocol for broker recruiting that I'm sure some of you have heard of. And just to give a high-level view of it, is it's something that was started back in 2004 by Citigroup, Merrill Lynch, and UBS. And it was done in order to try to figure out a way to not get involved in litigation over broker movement. And so what it does is, or I should stop and take a step back from it, I apologize, is it started in 2004. It really gained momentum during the financial crisis of 2008, 2009, into 2010. And you saw a lot of people signing up for this, and I think a lot of the reason why was because they didn't want to engage in litigation costs and litigation fees. They were kind of looking for a way that they could say, okay, I'm comfortable with these people leaving or doing these things in this situation. And so it's led to 473 signatories. So 473 securities firms have agreed to follow the protocol in the event that their brokers leave and go to another protocol member firm. I will also say, though, that it has died out some. For example, last year only 13 new members joined the protocol, and it'll be interesting to see, and us here at SafeHearth and three of us in the room will be monitoring this to see, does the protocol continue to build momentum, or is it now starting to die down as the markets agree, and I acknowledge that nobody knows what tomorrow will bring, but if the markets continue to grow and continue to do what they're doing the past recent days, it'll be interesting to see if the protocol stays where it's at, or if something else replaces it, or if less and less people decide to join, or in some situations actually start to leave it. It's administered by SIFMA, the Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association. So if you want to join the protocol, you contact SIFMA, who, by the way, as a side note, recently named a former Republican senator from Rhode Island, Judd Gregg, I think it was 3 days ago, to be their lead and their president. But you can notify them and say, we'd like to join the protocol. And once you fill out the appropriate paperwork, you then become a protocol member and are bound by it. And as I mentioned before, what the protocol does is it allows for reciprocal poaching. And what I mean by that is if your company signs the protocol and agrees to be bound by it, you agree that if a broker leaves you, he can take certain client information, namely the client's name, their address, and I mean both their hard address, their mailing address, as well as their email address, and the account title of what they were working on and what they did for that broker. It also allows the broker to solicit the clients that he serviced at his former firm with one limited exception. I'll talk about that in a minute. But what basically happens and what this means that you have to be aware of is even if you have an employment agreement with this broker that says, I agree for 1 year to not solicit my clients that I did business with while working for you, if you sign the protocol, you've given that up, and you've agreed that this person can solicit his former clients on behalf of his new employer. So obviously, that conflicts with potential restrictive covenants, and you should check your agreements to see if you have a solicitation clause, and then if you do, you should find out if you were or if you are a member of the protocol because you have given up that solicitation provision that's in your restrictive covenant. Also, a lot of your employment agreements talk about confidentiality, and they identify different types of confidentiality. And common in that identification is client addresses and telephone numbers. Well, you might have that in your written agreement that says, hey, broker, you agree that while you're working for us and afterwards, you won't disclose any of our confidential information to a third party, such as a competitor. Well, if you sign the protocol for broker recruiting, if you're a member of the protocol, you've now waived that right to claiming that information is confidential. And obviously, that's something you need to be aware of if you then go into court to get the return of that information through a temporary restraining order, or if you go into court to try to bar a solicitation. If you've signed the protocol, that'll be used against you, and the protocol has been held up to be valid and will be followed in the court system. So that leads to, okay, what does that mean? Well, first off, as I mentioned, the courts, as well as FINRA, will follow the protocol. So if you're a member firm, you should expect to be bound by the protocol in both the trial court level as well as at the FINRA level. And that makes it easy if there's a signatory plaintiff and a signatory defendant, because basically what the court and what FINRA, for that matter, will do is they'll say, okay, you guys signed the protocol. This broker's allowed to take this information. That's fine. He's allowed to solicit customers. That's fine. What else is there? And then you have to, go from there. Where it gets a little interesting is the signatory plaintiff and the non-signatory defendant. And why I say where that gets interesting is we have seen some cases in the courts, including a recent case last year in Indiana, rule is that if you have signed the protocol, it applies to you even if your broker goes to a non-signatory firm. And what I mean by that is if you're, let's say, for example, UBS, who has been a member of the protocol, if their brokers go to a non-protocol firm, what the Indiana trial court held was you've already said by signing the protocol that you don't care about solicitation and you don't care about people taking this information with them when they leave. So even though these people are going to a non-signatory firm, we're going to hold the protocol's obligations up to you, and therefore you cannot bring a request for injunctive relief, and you cannot bring a claim for confidential information violation with respect to email, address, name, phone number, and name, because you signed the protocol. That's important to know then if you're a protocol member. What is also true is the converse of that, and that is if you're a non-signatory plaintiff going against a signatory defendant, the protocol will not apply. And there have been several cases, including one in Ohio, one in Oklahoma, that said, listen, if it's a non-signatory plaintiff bringing an action against a signatory defendant, we don't care about the protocol because the signatory plaintiff did not agree to abide by it, and we're not going to follow it. So if you're a non-signatory plaintiff, you don't have to worry about the protocol. If you are a signatory member, you need to worry about the protocol, both in litigation that may arise between you and a signatory firm, as well as you and a non-signatory firm, because there is case law out there that says once you sign the protocol, you agree to it, and that means you agree to waive your solicitation rights, and you also agree that this confidential information, names, addresses, phone numbers, can be taken by the broker when he leaves you. And so, as we talked about, you need to look at your company agreements to determine what exactly do you define as confidential information, what do you say that their duties are when they leave you as well as when they're working with you, what does your restrictive covenant say with respect to solicitation, non-compete, non-hire, because if you're a protocol member, you need to understand how that impacts those restrictions. And then the one exception that I will talk about, which is interesting, and there was a case that came out of Minnesota last week on it. There is, most people don't read the protocol long enough to get there, but there is a carve-out in the protocol that talks about team agreements, and it doesn't really define what team agreements is. But what the court in Minnesota said, and if you read the protocol in its entirety, what it talks about is the following, and that is if you're somebody who works as a team, so there's situations where a broker has his own book and that's all he does and that's all he's ever done, and then there's sort of a team, right, where it's four or five people working on a group of customers or in a group of clientele or a certain market. If you're part of that team, there is a carve out in the protocol that says the protocol will not apply if you are a member of a team. So if you are a member of that team and you signed a team agreement, and in the Minnesota case, what they said was that team agreement contained, was your employment agreement where you agreed not to solicit these customers and you agreed not to take this confidential information, that team agreement will apply. And so you have to be careful because this still has to be fleshed out, and it's still very vague as to, how this will work out. But if you're having people come over to you and they were part of a team that serviced the entire book as a person who just serviced that book on his own, the protocol may not protect you if you're a protocol member because of this one exception. The Minnesota, even though the protocol has been around since 2004, this is the first case that I've actually seen that actually talks about the team exception to the protocol that says that, hey, guess what? If you're a protocol person, you may still have the ability to enforce a non-solicitation provision because you were servicing as part of a team as opposed to doing it all by yourself. The other thing that I would mention, and this applies to FINRA in general as well as the protocol, is rating. The protocol rules as well as the FINRA rules really talk about in terms of one-offs. And what I mean by one-offs is one person's leaving to go to another member firm, or two people are leaving together. That's much different scenario than a situation where it's a rating, where it's, you know, several offices leaving at once or several different members worldwide leaving to go to different things. In those situations, you really need to be careful because of two things. One, that's uncharted territory with respect to the protocol and the team agreements provision, could carve out rating and probably probably would. The second thing is it goes back to what we talked about, the informality of FINRA and the fact that at most you're going to have one person on your panel who's a lawyer, but you may not have any lawyers. And so you're looking at arbitrator justice. And when you have industry individuals, you always run the risk of a rating being looked at and through a negative way or in a negative light. So those are things that you need to keep in mind if you are going beyond what I would say, the one-off. You know, I'm just hiring one person or I'm hiring two people and that's it. So those are things you need to be concerned about. And that falls into mergers and acquisitions as well. And what I simply mean by that is you need to, if you're acquiring a company and you're not a protocol member firm, but that company you're acquiring is, it hasn't been decided yet, but it will be interesting to see if the protocol follows along with respect to those people and with those firms. My gut tells me it probably will not, but what you should know and what we've seen actually in some acquisitions is that when those people move over to this new company is that they push for and lobby for the company to join the protocol and for the reasons that we talked about earlier. So the last thing that Jason, Dan, and I would like to mention is the most important thing about trade secret protection is addressing the issue before it becomes a crisis. The old Ben Franklin adage, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, really applies to these types of cases. And the reason it does is it's always better to find out immediately and before things blow up on you as opposed to trying to put everything back together after the bomb's gone off. And so I think I speak for all three of us when we just say what we've talked about today, really the most of it talks about what to do before you get to the crisis. And that's what you should always be focused on is what can we do to prevent this or to help put our company in the best possible situation so that we're not looking at a situation after the fact where customers have lost, we don't have a TRO in place, things aren't going well for us in FINRA, and we're asking the question, well, how did we get to this spot? So with that, we'll take a brief moment here to look through some questions, and we'll be right back with you.
Hi again, it's Jason Steele. I do want to remind you guys, if you'd like, go ahead and submit questions via email or on the question and answer board. We're not taking any oral questions. One of the questions we got was, is there a way to protect non-public information with an agreement if that information wouldn't rise to the level of trade secret? And that's a good question. We always recommend in any employment agreement or handbook or policy you have is you have a confidentiality requirement with your employees at a bare minimum. And typically you want to define that as well as you can. A lot of courts recently have been giving those policies some scrutiny because a lot of people have relied on form documents that say, you'll see them. They'll say any inventions, products, roadmaps, da-da-da. It lists like 100 things that might be your confidential information. Well, that's not industry specific. The court may say, look, you've just basically protected things that you have no right to protect. So make sure you give a look to your confidentiality provisions to make sure you're protecting the kind of information you expect your employees to have access to. But for sure, put a confidentiality clause, and obviously those are pretty easy to enforce typically because they don't have the same scrutiny when you go into court that a restrictive covenant does regarding, you know, for example, temporal and geographic scope and the reasonableness of the provision.
And this is kind of for, again, I'll take another question, that is, do you have a view of the applicability of the protocol in the context of a notice requirement? Would the resigning broker be able to tender resignation and start right away at the new house despite a 30-60 or 90-day notice slash garden leave provision? It's a good question. Case law really hasn't been developed to a great extent on this issue, but there has been a case which has taken the position that, you know, during your garden leave, you're still an employee of your former or slash current employer, that you haven't gone over to the new company yet, and therefore the protocols events haven't been triggered. In other words, you haven't officially begun over there, so therefore you haven't achieved the right under the protocol for taking the customer information that's allowed under the protocol as well as soliciting those customers. And with that, we'll wait another moment or two to see if there's any additional questions.
Please submit your question via the chat or press star.
All right. I believe we've answered all your questions. Thank you very much for spending your lunch hour or your late morning or early afternoon with us. You have our contact information, so if there's any additional information that Dan, Jason, or myself can answer for you, by all means, please feel free to email us or contact us. Have a good day.
Thank you.
A great Memorial Day weekend.
Thank you again for joining us today. This concludes today's web conference. You may now disconnect.